Welcome to the Propagandist Podcast, Confusion to Our Enemies.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Narvey with the Propagandist Podcast. I'm here today with Jonathan Danilowitz, our Israeli contributing writer in Tel Aviv. Actually, we've got a few Israeli contributing writers, but Jonathan Danilowitz has been with us pretty much from the beginning, writing some excellent articles and making some very insightful contributions to our political magazine. So Jonathan is he's been living in Israel for about I guess it's 40 years now. How long have you been there?
That's right. I came here in 1971, so it's exactly 40 years ago that I left South Africa.
Yes. So you grew up in South Africa. And you know, one of the one of the memes, one of the themes that we hear from activists who criticize Israel is, of course, the idea that Israel is an apartheid state. So I thought, you know, how interesting would it be to hear from someone such as yourself who has direct experience of what an apartheid state really is like, and of course then moved onto Israel. And, you know, what is your perspective? Maybe you could give us some background on what it was like growing up in South Africa.
Well, thanks, Jonathan, firstly for saying those kind words about my writing. And I must say in response how much I enjoy reading The Propagandist and what a great job you and the other contributors do. As you pointed out, I did grow up in South Africa in a fairly small town, certainly nothing the size of Johannesburg or Toronto or Vancouver or whatever. A small town where the major language was, in fact, Afrikaans. South Africa was a bilingual country, English and Afrikaans. It was actually a multilingual country because many of the native Africans, not many of them, all of them had their own native languages. So, but the two official languages of the country were English and Afrikaans, and I grew up in an Afrikaans-speaking town, although I did go to an English-speaking school. I was Jewish, I am Jewish, and suffered, unhappily at times, from quite a lot of anti-Semitism, some of it very overt from young boys and sometimes girls at school. And some of it less overt, some of it covert stuff that we'd read in the newspapers, headlines that had a subtle twist of anti-Semitism to them. So I was very, very aware of anti-Semitism in South Africa. As a young child in this apartheid country, where apartheid was the official policy of the government, I did not understand that there should be any other way of living. We did not have television. There was no television in South Africa. There was severe censorship of books and newspapers. There was no Skype, internet, of course, and faxes and all that kind of stuff. So we lived a pretty insular life, fed by the government of what was right. I didn't know any different. Only when I grew up, when I went to university, when I started reading, when I spoke to people who had been overseas, who had been abroad. My parents first went abroad in 1957, and that was very unusual. I think the whole town turned out to say goodbye to them and to wish them a good trip. I mean, the whole town, the Jewish community, of course, I'm talking about. When they came back and they spoke, they had actually gone to several countries, including Israel. And I remember my mother coming back and saying that she had stayed in the same hotel where there were black people from Ghana. And she was horrified or amused, let me say. I'm not sure how horrified she was, but she thought that was something very, very strange, that in Israel, black people and white people could stay and share the same hotel. So those were the kind, that was the kind of background I grew up with, and I knew apartheid very, very intimately, where there were separate buses, separate trains, separate restaurants. You couldn't go to the same movie house. Certainly there was total separation of the sexes. There was no interracial sex at all. It was completely forbidden. No, certainly no interracial marriage. Education was completely separate. In fact, every possible aspect of life that you could imagine was separated between black and white. When I came to Israel for the first time, which was in 1966 on a visit, my eyes were opened, realizing that there was another way. I returned to South Africa. I came back to Israel in 1967, and I stayed for 6 months as a volunteer during the Six-Day War. Then I was really exposed to a lot of foreign influence here. I met Russians for the first time. South Africa had been a violently anti-communist country. We were threatened constantly by the, or told constantly by the government how communism was a major threat to us. And I imagined, I had such a weird idea of what Russians would be like, and I came along and met them here in Israel, and they were just like me. What a surprise. Nice people too. I went back to South Africa again, stayed there until 1971 when I first came to Israel. Now, when I read about comments like, Israel is an apartheid country, I have only two responses. The one is that the person saying that either has simply no idea what apartheid was all about, or they know and ignore the issues and use that label, apartheid Israel, simply to denigrate and delegitimize the country.
Now, there can be no... Okay, then why would you say that? Because, you know, that's a pretty, strong indictment of the type of language these activists are using, essentially to suggest that, you know, obviously it's like black and white. They're perhaps an inappropriate use, but what they believe is true is demonstrably 100% false. Could you give us maybe some examples of, you know, how is life different in Israel, even back then, and today?
Well, Jonathan, South Africa's apartheid policy was based on denying political and civil rights, or withholding them as far as possible, on a purely racial basis. Whereas in Israel, everybody has equal political and civil rights. This is the broadest possible way I can tell you. In South Africa, black people could not vote. In South Africa, black people had no civil rights. In Israel, everybody who is an Israeli citizen can vote and has full civil rights. So, when in South Africa, for example, as I said before, black people couldn't ride on the same bus that I rode on. Whereas here in Israel, of course, there's no separation, of course. Anything like that. In South Africa, there would have been separate courts for black and white people. And when I say separate, I don't mean separate but equal. They were separate and very unequal. Whereas here in Israel, we have Arabs, for example, who... There is an Arab man who is a Supreme Court judge, and we have many, many Arabs who are judges in lower courts. In South Africa, you would not find a black supermarket checkout clerk, as something as mundane as that, or a black bus driver in a white bus. There was total separation of the races based purely on our color, on the color of one's skin.
All right, so, you know, it seems pretty clear to me, and obviously to you, and yet, what do you think explains the persistence of this, you know, this characterization of Israel as an apartheid state, which has been, I suppose it first picked up force in the, what was it called, the, it was a UN conference from the early
2000s. The Durban,
conference. Yes, yeah. That.
Well, in actual fact, it started long before that, Jonathan. If you remember the United Nations passing a resolution equating Zionism with racism. Do you remember that
Absolutely,
resolution?
Yes, yes.
Yes, it was subsequently rescinded. But that was about the first time that a major political body, and the United Nations cannot be considered minor, although I think it's a huge failure, but that's a discussion for another podcast some other time. That was the first time that a major political organization had really passed such a resolution equating Israeli Zionism or Zionism with racism. And it developed from there. One has to remember that Israel and South Africa were forced into each other's arms, if I can use that expression, in a certain political way by the Arab countries, the oil-producing Arab countries themselves. When Israel was established in 1948, and as it happens, coincidentally, just 2 weeks later, the National Party, the Apartheid Party, won the elections in South Africa. That's pure coincidence. Israel was not an enemy of South Africa, but was certainly not a friend, and voted in United Nations resolutions consistently against South Africa. There were no diplomatic relations between Israel and South Africa for many, many years. And Israel courted the African states one by one, helping them, educating them on agricultural, mostly on agricultural and scientific issues, opening embassies in all the capitals of African states. And Israel had a wonderful relationship with most of Africa until the 1967 war, which I have to remind some of your readers was listeners was started by the Arabs and not by Israel. Israel, of course, was the outstanding winner of that war. One by one, the African states, under pressure from the wealthy oil-producing Arab countries, broke off their diplomatic relations with Israel. Israel lost many, many friends, and more importantly, perhaps, many, many trading partners. And Israel was desperate for support, for international support, and as I said, was more or less thrown into the arms of South Africa. South Africa supplied Israel then with spare parts for its Mirage jets and other military equipment, which South Africa desperately needed. Don't forget, the Cold War was still on, and many, many countries, including Canada, the United States, Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom certainly, were voting against South Africa at the United Nations and trading heavily with her and supporting her because they wanted to keep the Soviet Union influence out of South Africa. Mm. So there's complex political issues going on. And as I said, South Africa and Israel became good friends. They supported each other. Diplomatic relations were established. The Prime Minister of South Africa, John Vorster, actually visited visited Israel. Relations became very good. Now people look at Israel, point a finger and say, how could you? But of course they ignore the fact that almost the whole world traded with South Africa and propped up that country. I mean, where do people think oil came from in South Africa? Except for a very short period in the 1970s, after the October War in Israel, there was no time ever in South Africa's history that they were not floating in oil. And that oil all came from the Arab countries.
Well, unfortunately, ignorance of the facts is not something that's exclusive to people who were living in the 1970s, hence the situation we're in today. Are you optimistic that this characterization of Israel as an apartheid state is something that has been maybe discredited and will ultimately be accepted by most people, by most reasonable people, as, you know, an utter falsehood, a defamation, you know, that this is simply not true. Will the world accept that, you know, Israel is what it is, a Western democracy providing civil rights to all, and coincidentally happening to be in the Middle East, in the middle of a whole bunch of countries that do not are not characterized as democracies that respect civil rights?
Tough question, Jonathan. You know, the United Nations today has an automatic anti-Israel majority. And you could pass any resolution there you like, as long as it had an anti-Israel theme. And unfortunately, many people still look at the United Nations as a valid body, defining how the world should look, defining how the world should vote, defining how we should respect or disrespect each other. And as long as the Arab oil weapon threatens the Western world as it does today, as long as we do not have renewable energy sources and that we are dependent upon the Arab world, I'm afraid that I will remain very pessimistic about how the world will look at Israel. I mean, if we can just take Saudi Arabia as an example, I cannot understand how women, specifically mentioning women today and not men, how any woman could not accuse that country of gender apartheid. How any woman could spend her energy criticizing and delegitimizing Israel when a country like Saudi Arabia does not allow women to drive, let alone vote, where women cannot walk out in the street without a male escort, where unmarried women are considered to be not adult enough to make decisions, to sign contracts, to open bank accounts. And yet we find that women are ready to come to Israel, to criticize Israel, to go on these flotillas and ignore gender apartheid, genuine gender apartheid in Saudi Arabia. So, no, I'm very, unfortunately, and as I said, until the oil weapon is removed and the United Nations becomes sane, I'm rather pessimistic, unhappily. And I'd like to just go back to another question you asked me, and I didn't answer it, although I didn't want to, I'm not avoiding it, when you asked me, Jonathan, whether what the reason for this anti-Semitism is, for this accusation of Israel apartheid is. And I think that it is a representation of basic racist anti-Semitism. These people are looking for some way, they're anti-Semites, they are looking for some way to delegitimize the state of Israel.
You've been listening to the Propagandist Podcast. For more great content, go to the Propagandist Magazine at www.propagandistmag.com.